demon should fear me. You're not a demon, are you?
It was licking me!
Are they slow moving, Chief?
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Planet of Terror podcast. I am your host, Cortez the Killer. Tonight, I have with me very special guest, writer-director Philip Gelott. He of the independent horror feature, The Bleeding House. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So his film had a premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival this year, and had a run on video on demand and has now seen a DVD and Blu-ray release. So, Philip, if you can for us, please set the stage for us a little bit and tell us a little bit about the film and kind of give us a brief synopsis.
Yeah, the film is a horror slash dark thriller movie about a family that lives somewhere in middle America, and they have a kind of dark past, and one day a seemingly charming stranger comes to the house, and horrible things ensue.
So how did the idea for the film come about? So as kind of the writer and...
I mean, it's funny. I don't exactly remember. I know a guy in the Midwest in Wisconsin, and I know that one of the early moments that led to the script was that I... you know, like around my hometown, there are a lot of sort of strange back roads where there are just farmhouses on roads. And I was like, oh, that's a creepy thing. And I didn't really understand, like, what these people did. I mean, maybe they're farmers, but a lot of them didn't seem to have functioning farms. So I just thought that was kind of interesting, and it got me thinking about, I guess, kind of a family that's heyday has passed. And then everything else just kind of came from there. I mean, the script underwent a lot of changes in the development process. But at a certain point, I sort of knew that I wanted it to come down to a conflict between, you know, the sort of almost mythic stranger character who just kind of wanders to this home, and the sort of creepy daughter of the family in the house. But I don't really know where those two elements came from. They just sort of appeared in my head, I guess.
So that's definitely an interesting aspect of the film. Let's talk about that for a minute. So I really liked how the film kind of kept you guessing a bit as to kind of this family's secret. And you kind of know that something is up kind of from the get-go. You know, you notice mom is really anxious and keeps things locked in drawers. Dad can't find work, so there's some sort of reputation there that he's trying to kind of get over, or there's this sort of hump that he's trying to get over in order to find work in this new small town that the family's moved to. And the daughter, while strange and kind of antisocial at times, just seems kind of like your normal kind of reclusive teenager until you kind of realize that she has her own little secret that's revealed in the film. Don't want to delve too much into it and kind of play the spoils here, but it really plays really great effect at the beginning of the film that it kind of bounces around a little bit and kind of keeps you guessing as to kind of who's keeping and harboring this secret ultimately. And then, you know, kind of as you mentioned with our stranger Nick that kind of arrives on the scene, he then again kind of throws everything off and you wonder about his intentions. And then you learn of the secret later on and the focus is kind of shifted again with his own secret. So kind of this whole play and this misdirection is very prevalent throughout the film. Kind of talk about that a little bit, and was that intentional?
Yeah, it was definitely intentional. I mean, it's funny, I don't like twist movies very much. Like, I think M. Night Shyamalan's an okay director, but I don't like the sort of very, very end of the movie twist. But I mean... People have told me this movie has a twist on it. I resent that remark, I guess. I mean, I feel like I'm more into movies that have a kind of, that keep you guessing for a little while and that allow pieces of information in an organic way.
And that's definitely how I feel about the film. It definitely comes across as very organic, and it's not the big aha moment. You know something's up, and you're kind of picking up bits and pieces as you go along. And then to the point where Nick just flips a switch and you go, all right, we know who this guy is now.
Yeah, exactly. And it was fun. I mean, you know, I'd never directed anything before, so it was a lot of the movie, a lot of the pacing of the movie, and a lot of those things I had a general sense going in, but then they sort of arose just in the way that we ended up shooting it and the way we ended up making it. So it's funny, like, I kind of went in, like, certainly the script had a level of, a pretty high degree of intentionality in certain things, but going into making it, a lot of that intentionality kind of just went away because I really had no previous experience. But then, so then you have to kind of like build it back in the, you know, a lot of sort of editing, which was really, intense and kind of fascinating to do. But, yeah, I think it turned out pretty well. I'm pretty pleased with it.
Absolutely. I mean, so that was another remark that I was going to make. I mean, for a first time production, I mean, extremely skilled. I mean, definitely not amateur in the least. I definitely knew what you were doing. I was very surprised to learn that myself. I was like, who is this guy? I want to see what else he's done. So I went on.
That's it. That's all you got. That's all you get.
Well, it really was. I mean, I like to think I'm pretty connected. You know, I've been running the blog for about 5 years now, and mm-hmm. I have a group of fellow bloggers that we kind of keep in touch with each other and kind of let each other know kind of what's going on within the genre. And you know, it was literally one of those things. You know, I had gotten a new home theater installed in the house, and I was just flipping through Vudu, and I saw, oh, Bleeding House, that sounds kind of interesting. So I watched the trailer, and I was immediately hooked. And so when I watched it, and when it was done, I was like, I immediately went to IMDb to check out the film's page. And when I clicked on your name, like, wow, this is his first feature film? I was just astounded. I was like, this guy's done more in one film than probably a lot of other folks that I've seen. So
that's very kind of you to say.
So kudos there for sure.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I was very, very fortuitous. We had the guy who shot the movie is a guy named Frederick Fasano, who shot most, not all, but I think most of Dario Argento's last features. So I think what we can agree are his subpar features. But he shot he shot Mother of Tears, and he shot Giallo, which I never even saw, and he shot Do You Like Hitchcock, I think, are the three that he shot. So he, I mean, he, I'm kind of still astounded that he agreed to work with us. He kind of, very sweet guy. He, like, he just moved to New York, and, you know, he came in to meet with us, and he was like, you have no money to work with, and you're only going to pay me, like, you know, a fraction of my normal rate? I love this. It would be like I'm a kid again. So he was, like, really, you know, really kind of essential to the process, and kind of, you know, certainly helped bring a level of, I don't know, like prestige and quality to the product that had we had a less experienced DP would have definitely been lacking. And he's very sweet, and I'm sorry that he didn't shoot some of Argento's better movies, but, you know, what can you do? Did you see Giallo? Not to go on a tangent, but have you seen Giallo?
I have not. That's the one with Adrian Brody where he got ticked off, right? That he's
yes,
like,
that he got super ticked off, yeah.
I don't want this to be released. It's not a great movie by any means. No, I have not.
Yeah, neither have I.
I've seen Mother of Tears, though, and outside of a few pretty decent gore scenes, which, you know, he's never had a problem with at all, it was a jumbled mess of a film.
It really wasn't. It's funny how, like, I mean, Suspiria is, I think, objectively speaking, a bit of a jumbled mess, too, but for some reason, it works, and Mother of Tears, for some reason, does not work, so who knows?
Right, right. Yeah, and to be honest, and I might get blasted for this later on by followers or whatnot, but I've never really been a big fan of Dario Argento. I've never really understood his appeal. I mean, stylistically, yeah, it's really awesome stuff, and visual. In terms of visuals, he's done some phenomenal things for the genre and just defining that aspect. But just an overall dialogue and storytelling, I don't know. Maybe something gets lost in translation, I don't know. But
yeah.
I just, on the whole, it's just not my cup of tea.
I hear what you're saying. I go in phases. I'm a pretty big fan of, you know, like three or four of his seminal movies, and the rest of it's kind of, you know, take it or leave it for me.
Right. So back to the film again. So you had a premiere at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
How was it received there?
It was received very well. I mean, it was a weird. It was a weird experience being in a festival. Like, I'm very, like, I write comic books, too. I don't know if you know that. Like, I have a very weird relationship with things that I do, where I like to do them and then not have to, like, celebrate them in some sense. So, like, the Turbine Film Festival was weird to me just because it was, like, a lot of pomp and a lot of, like, it was a very well-moneyed festival, so, like, they kept throwing parties and, like, buying me dinner and things, and I just felt very weird about the whole thing. But, you know, I think it was very well received from the audiences that I, you know, that I saw it with. They all seemed to respond really well, and I had a moment, like, I did a number of Q&As, like, after each screening, and all of our screenings were midnight screening, you know, 2 a.m. Q&As, and every time we had one, I was convinced that I was going to get up there and there was going to be somebody in the audience who would just stand up and ask, like, why the movie sucks so much. I never got that question, thank God, and, like, all the Q&A sessions actually were really, really good, and the audience had, like, really astute and interesting questions, and it was, you know, it was a really good experience. I mean, I'm still, like, a little bit shocked by the whole experience because I really didn't expect to be in a festival like that. So,
yeah.
But it was, you know, it was a good experience, definitely. And weird, too, because, like, you know, we're not, like, we didn't have any stars in the movie. So like, a lot more attention festival-wise was being paid to the movies that had, like, Eva Mendes and Zach Braff and all these other, like, sort of starred movies.
Right.
Which was interesting, and it was fun then to talk to people who work at the festival because they were all, they all loved us because we were very, like, down to earth and very, like, you know, get ourselves to the theater. You don't need to send a car for us. Like, I'll take the subway. It's no big deal. So it was, you know, it was fun.
That's cool. That's cool. Did you get to meet Robert De Niro?
I did not get to meet Robert De Niro. I got to meet other higher ups in Tribeca who aren't stars. So. I don't even think I saw anybody famous while I was at the festival. Like, it was, I didn't get to see, anybody too fancy.
So back to, the film a little bit. So let's talk a little bit about, Patrick Brain, who plays mm-hmm. the role of Nick.
Yep.
And, you know, not to downplay anyone else's performance, but I'm going to say, in my humble opinion, he absolutely made the film.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of going back to the family. So we kind of established that there's something up with them and they're harboring this dark secret. And then to kind of throw things off a bit, you know, they're met with the father goes out when the young son is going outside to go off to go visit his girlfriend, and he goes out to try to capture his son after a pretty intense moment at the dinner table. And he runs into Nick on his front doorstep. And at first you kind of see, well, who is this weird guy, you know, dressed from head to toe in white? And then as he starts talking to the man of the house, his charm, his southern charm kind of takes over. And you start to think, all right, well, maybe he's not a bad guy here without any ill intent. So he's kind of unassuming at first, even though you kind of taken aback by his adornment from head to toe of all white. And then that kind of unravels when he gets to end the home and settles in. But from there on out, you know, from this transition of kind of like this guy who kind of charms the pants off of everyone in the family and befriends them and stays with them for the night as this traveler, to this thing where this switch just goes on and we kind of see him for the monster that he is, was just an amazing transition. And just really the weight of his performance is what I believe which ultimately carries the film. Kind of talk about his performance a little bit. And I know he's been a character actor too.
Yeah, he has. He's sort of big in certain New York theater circles. So I kind of knew him from his live theater work, and he's done a lot of, like, he's in Men in Black as an alien, and he's in
Holy cow! You know what? When you just said that, I instantly got that in my head. He was the
yep.
Which one was he? Was he the what was his name?
I don't know what his name was, but he was in Alien. Like, in the first movie, he's, like, I think an alien having a kid by the side, who has a kid by the side
yes,
of the boat or something.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly who he is. He's the husband, and his wife is giving birth to the alien baby on the side of the road. Wow.
Yes. Yep, and he's in Galaxy Quest as an alien. He's like one of the aliens that they have, like, of the race that they have to try to save.
Isn't that amazing sometimes when you, like, you make that connection, you go, oh yeah, he's that guy from that movie, and he did
that. Exactly. And then, like, that's who Patrick Green is. He's like one of those guys. You're like, oh shit, he's that guy.
Yeah.
But he was a lot of fun to work with. I mean, I was, of all the departments in the movie, I think I was slightly most intimidated by the actors just because, like, every department in a movie kind of has their own vocabulary, and I never, I don't know, I mean, it took me a little while to understand, like, what an actor's vocabulary is and how to communicate with them, but he was really great, and came with a particular interpretation of the character. Like, I think if you were to read the script, you would have thought that Nick was, I think, a little bit more immediately ominous, and Patrick was like, you know what, I really want to play this character, and I really want to up the ambiguity of it in the beginning of the movie, and then play him very, almost, I mean, not softly, but I mean, there is a certain softness to the way that he's played, I think, that adds actually to how interesting the performance is. And, you know, it's funny, he doesn't turn super, super crazy in the movie until the very, very last scene, and he really pulled it, like, he turns it way, way up, and it works really, really well, especially in comparison with, like, how he's been playing it the rest of the movie.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an important distinction to make, that he, even though we kind of know something's up, like, I'd probably say, like, close to midway through, or probably even before that, probably the second act, really. But he, to him, it's like, it's still his, within his character. It's not played over the top. It's very, mm-hmm. it's very calm, cool, collected, still charming, but also at the same time very calculating and underlyingly kind of sinister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think he'd ever played that kind of, like, a villainous role before. I think he was really having a good time. For some reason, like, a lot of our downtime on set, we spent talking about Blade Runner. I have no idea why, and there was this moment when he...
Because it's an awesome movie?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. I don't know how we got on the topic. But I think he pegged me as a nerd, like, a pretty, like, just a capital N nerd pretty early, so I think he figured he could talk to me about science fiction if we had nothing else to talk about. But I will say this, he... thought he had Roy Batty's memorized correctly. As it turns out, he didn't, but I didn't have the heart to correct him. So if Patrick ever listens to this, I'm sorry to say that you were actually incorrect in some of Roy Batty's monologue from the end of Blade Runner. And I can't remember. I think it's the bit about the Tannhauser Gate he didn't get right, but, you know.
Oh, okay.
Awesome.
But it's just, it was such a brilliant performance, and it just kind of made me kind of stand up and take notice and just say, wow, this is just, I mean, from, if we're just talking about strictly horror films from the last few years, it's definitely a standout performance that just, like I said, just, it really carries the film and really makes it ultimately.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a hard role to cast too, because it's so, I mean, the movie, like, if you break the script down, I think 85% of the lines are Nick's lines. Like, he talks that whole movie. You know, if it's, you know, like, wasn't able to pull it off, we were going to be in serious, serious trouble.
Right. Absolutely. Yep.
But he did a really good job.
So talk a little bit, just kind of shifting gears here a little bit. Talk about your filmmaking influences, either past or present.
I have an array of influences. I have this, like, story that I tell about the influences that went into making this movie, where I, when we started making it, I really thought that we were making it for such a low budget that I was just having people watch, like, the first Texas Chainsaw, because I was like, oh, we'll do it, like, it'll be kind of, like, we'll shoot it down something that can do that same kind of gritty film stock, and we'll make a movie that's has the same kind of manic energy as Texas Chainsaw. And then at some point, I mean, clearly the movie is not Texas Chainsaw Massacre at all.
Yep.
So at a certain point, I don't remember how it happened, but I completely switched to this Japanese movie called Cure by this guy, Kiyoshi Kurosawa. I don't know if you've seen it, but if you haven't seen it, it's a really, really interesting, I guess it's a horror movie, and it's a movie about a guy, investigating a series of crimes that are seemingly committed at random, and it turns out that there's this crazy hypnotist who's hypnotizing, like, random strangers to commit murders. And it's a really, like, moody and very sort of staid and evenly paced Japanese horror movie that I absolutely love. And it stylistically could not be farther from Texas Chainsaw. So we ended up with a movie that bears much more resemblance to Cure than it does to Texas Chainsaw.
It's simply called Cure?
I think it's simply called Cure. It might be The Cure. Okay. But I think it's just called Cure. And the guy's last name is Kurosawa, which is easy enough to remember, and his first name is Kiyoshi. But, I mean, aside from that, like, I don't know, I'm a huge fan of all kinds of people. Like, I really like Roman Polanski's movies. I think he's absolutely brilliant, regardless of his personal life. Although I do find his personal life really fascinating. Like if you want to talk about, like, distinctive, one-of-a-kind biographies, I don't know that in you know, the history of film, there are many that have as distinct of a personal history as Polanski, which I think definitely adds something to his work.
Yep.
And I really like, you don't see a lot of David Cronenberg in anything I've written or anything that the one thing I've directed, but I am actually a really huge David Cronenberg fan. I think he's, he brings a certain, intellectual severity to everything he does. Like, even his earliest movies are so, like, intellectually rigorous, but then also, like, so drenched in bizarre sexuality, I think it's just really...
Yep.
And, I don't know, like, you know, Texas Chainsaw, obviously, I love Tobe Hooper, and I love Tobe Hooper's, like, mid-80s movies. I'm a really big fan of, like, Texas Chainsaw 2, and Life Force, and Invaders from Mars, I'll even defend, even though it's not that good a movie.
From a pure, like, yeah, kid standpoint, I loved that movie. It freaked me out when I was...
Yeah, like...
I'm a product of the 80s myself, so I remember that movie vividly.
I remember seeing it as a kid, and it freaked the hell out of me, and then I totally forgot about it. I had no idea what it was, and, like, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I was talking with my wife, and we both had this weird memory of this movie, and it turned out to be Invaders from Mars. And then we looked it up, and I was like, oh, my God, Tobe Hooper made that movie. That's awesome. And then we rewatched it. And it, you know, as with a lot of things from childhood, it's a little bit disappointing when you rewatch it. But it was still, you know, it still has its moments. I find really influential. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. It kind of depends on the day. Like, I try to be as broad in my consumption of things as I can, just to sort of, like, pick and choose and blend as much as I can to keep things fresh, you know?
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I'm in my like, writing office. I have three movie posters. One is Cronenberg's Crash, one is Romero's Dawn of the Dead, and one is Polanski's The Tenant. So I think that...
Excellent films.
Yeah, kind of sums it up.
Awesome. So kind of back to the film a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read some other reviews online, but I thought this was just kind of interesting. It didn't really occur to me until after I had watched the film. I don't know if this is intentional or completely just coincidence. But the character of Nick, you know, there's a certain methodology that he kind of deploys when we kind of learn of who he is as a monster. Mm-hmm. And it's very reminiscent of Dexter from the TV show Dexter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you had seen those comparisons or not. I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that, if that was...
It's funny. I wrote the very first early drafts of the script before I was aware of Dexter. And then I've watched maybe three episodes of Dexter in my life. So it's entirely a coincidental overlap. I know a lot of people who love Dexter, and I was never a big fan, but it's odd to me that it has such echoes of it. But yeah, I mean, there definitely is a certain similar methodology to it.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you a Dexter fan?
I am. I love it. It's actually one of the few shows... I'm not a big TV fan. I would rather come home and watch movies.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife is a huge TV fanatic. So it's one of the few TV shows that we kind of agree upon that like to watch together. And she's mm-hmm. and she's doesn't like anything horror related at all. Like she cannot watch. We're both night and day.
Interesting. So,
but it's kind of it has you know kind of the horror element to it. And it's but one of the few that we actually get into and watch together. So yeah, we're on what is it now? We're on season five? No, six coming up.
Oh wow! Yeah, I've been meaning to give it another shot, but I haven't gotten around to it. I like Paul. Actor's name?
Yeah,
I love him. I mean, it's funny. I love him as an actor, but I wasn't even really that big a fan of 6 Feet Under either. So I don't know why in my mind I like him so much, but I know that I do. So.
Yeah, he's just kind of like this dry kind of. He reminds me of the Fox Mulder character from X-Files. Very kind of like dry humor. He's just kind of like, yeah, kind of a strange guy. But you just you're drawn to him and ultimately find him just this lovable, even though he's got this dark side about him. You know.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. Yeah, I just thought I'd ask that. I thought it was kind of interesting. I was reading some reviews and people had drawn that connection. I was like, oh wow, you know, I didn't really thought about that. And then I looked back on it, and I'm like, oh, that kind of a.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's definitely an overlap there, and it was. I mean, it was brought up to me a couple times, even prior to production. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it means, but it surely means something.
So kind of back to so I'm interested by a point you made around kind of initially how you had thought about the film and filming it and just kind of this kind of frenetic pace that was, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre
mm-hmm.
and how it evolved into kind of like this more atmospheric, very kind of slow burn approach. So mm-hmm. talk about kind of like that evolution a little bit and how that kind of changed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I wish I remembered. I should have kept a journal or something as to why and how it changed. I think, you know, I think actually part of it was weirdly budgetary. I mean, it's weird to say that because Texas Chainsaw had, you know, that style of film doesn't actually require that large of a. At a certain point when I was looking at the script and thinking about making it, I knew that we were going to have to pull. We weren't going to have the time necessarily to build, to put all the pieces together to maintain a very quick pace. So the focus was going to need to be on getting something a little bit more unsettling and a little bit more, I don't know, I mean, ambiguous is the wrong word, and atmospheric, I guess, is the right word. And it's funny, like, it kind of suits my... I mean, it suits my tastes actually very well, too, because, I mean, you know, Polanski's early movies are very, very much, not slow burns, but they're atmospheric movies, and they're, like, you know, psychological movies that aren't necessarily all about grabbing you and throwing you into a really crazy situation. They're more sort of about exploring a situation and letting things unfold as they, you know, as they will.
Right.
And I think, you know, a strong contrarian... vein in me, and I think part of it to me was the appeal in making a horror movie that didn't fit current horror movie trends. So I think the shadow of Texas Chainsaw is very, very long, and it had a lot of horror movies these days are very, very much about that. And I mean, a lot of action movies, I mean, I guess a lot of movie making in general these days is shot in a very like quick, frenetic way, and that's very much the style of the time.
Yep.
And I being a contrarian, I think part of the appeal was, like, I'm going to make a movie that's utterly not like that and, you know, see how that works. So, you know, all those things converging, like budget and, you know, my taste and, you know, current style trends all kind of, you know, funneled into making the movie what it became. Does that answer that question? That might have been really convoluted.
No, absolutely. And from my own perspective, that's something that I've appreciated more about. So I can definitely say within the last few years, there's been just more of an overall a risk taken with filmmakers and making horror films, going back to that traditional kind of really building of suspense and just kind of having this really engrossing film where it's not all about the frenetic pace and the blood and gore in your face and TNA and all that stuff, but it's where it just boils down to the most basic element of fear and characters and what's going to happen to these people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I so much appreciated about the film, that, you know, they're just, it was just boiling down to a basic level. Even though you knew something was off with this family, you could tell that they were trying to keep everything together, and there was a good intention there at the beginning, and until it just kind of all boils over and things break apart. But, I mean, just that approach with a film, for me, as, you know, a longtime film fan, I've been much more appreciative and gravitate towards those films, generally speaking, nowadays.
It's funny. I also have this thing. I write screenplays for a living too, like screenplays for higher stuff. And I have a, which isn't really related to my point, although tangentially I guess it is, which is that I have this problem. I even had it like arguments with the producers. Like I really don't like to have a movie say, like, spell things out, I guess, and so there were a lot of conflicts in this movie, like, where I didn't want, like, for a long time there were arguments about, like, well, you have to, you know, like, let's spell out exactly what is going on in this weird daughter's head, and, like, why is she the way she is, and, like, let's, like, pinpoint exactly the source of her problem, and let's spell it out, and let's kind of, you know, and I don't like to do that. Like, I feel like there's a certain level of trust that one should have in their audience to, like, be involved enough in the story to sort of fill in their own blanks and, like, come to their own conclusions and stuff like that.
Absolutely. And those are the films that I've really celebrated and kind of championed myself for the last couple of years, where you're not really spoon-fed everything, and it's not that typical Hollywood approach. It's like, we've got to, you know, over-exposition everything, so there's no, you know, all of our I's are dotted and T's are crossed, and, you know, there's no question in the mind of the viewer at the end of the film what this thing was about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of films like yours, and another film that I've been a huge fan of the last few years called Dawning, where it's really left up to the devices of the viewer to kind of figure out what's going on. And it can mean a whole many things to somebody, or it can mean one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just to have the faith in the viewer to kind of come up with your own conclusions. Yeah, it's an incredible film. And that's a kind of another interesting journey as well, how that film kind of went from gone through numerous iterations, but had kind of completed around 2008. It's been on this journey for the last few years. And, you know, not to toot my own horn or other horror bloggers, but, you know, it was one of those things that kind of picked up steam among the blogging community.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a awesome, awesome thing to see from just fans of film and people that love great filmmaking and great storytelling in general to see actually get picked up. But kind of back to my point, you know, this whole kind of the filmmaker having faith in the audience not to have to spell everything out is just something that is just – so appreciative of just the general fan, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
But you do see folks every now and then. It's funny how the internet makes everyone a critic and saying how, oh, this is there was no closure here. What, this is BS. There was no payoff. And
yeah.
And that's troublesome and bothers me sometimes. And I want to get on my soapbox, or I just want to reach through the computer. I always liken it to if. have you ever seen the Kevin Smith movie Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back?
I have seen it, yes.
Where Jay and Silent Bob, they're at movies and they're looking up on a on the interwebs, and they're on a website, some film website, and they're looking at pre-posted comments about the movie that's going to be made about them, and they print off a list of all these commenters, and then they get on a plane and go to each one's doorstep, and with the printed off comments, they read it back to the person. And then they presume to beat the crap out of them. Sometimes I wish I had the means and money to do that sometimes, because, like, I don't understand people sometimes, and the internet turns them into these people. But anyways, I digress.
Yeah, the internet, there's no faster way to lose faith in humanity than to read the internet, like, especially comment sections on the internet, will very quickly destroy your faith in humanity.
That was the worst thing that CNN ever introduced within this last year, is people being able to log in via their Facebook and post comments.
I didn't know they did that. That's horrible.
Oh, my God. After, like, any news story. And it's just, it's terrible. I mean, some people might be trolling and just making a joke out of it, really. But some of the times, like, I just read comments, I'm like, I think this could be somebody actually, this is their mindset. This is what they actually believe.
Yeah, yeah.
My God. Anyways, so just my overall point being, you know, I appreciate the fact that filmmakers, you know, they don't have to feel like they have to spell everything out, and they actually have faith in their audience.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was for some reason thinking about it and discussing The Shining recently with somebody, and they were talking about how there's no, because The Shining is like, it's a funny movie because it seems to be such a straightforward ghost story, but when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, like, a lot of the pieces add up in a really weird way. And they were just like, we were sort of discussing what that meant, and it ended up being sort of discussion of, like, Hollywood development processes. And I mean, I think it's quite obvious that, like, had The Shining been put through a Hollywood development process, like, almost none of that movie would be as it is, as it was shot, and what, you know, and that's kind of what makes it so amazing, is that, you know, if that movie were made today, all of the interesting parts of it would have been developed out of it, and it would have been a much more straightforward and much less interesting movie.
Absolutely. Yep. I completely agree.
Yeah.
That movie still gets to me to this day, no matter how many times I watch it. I'm like,
yeah, it's really incredible.
I still haven't seen the remake that Stephen King did, the TV series with the guy from Wings.
Why would you see it? Like, what's the point?
Yeah, I don't understand that. Which brings me to my next question. To remake or not to remake? That is the question.
That's a really good question. I find it very easy to get on the don't remake train, but there are clearly reasons to remake. For example, John Carpenter's The Thing is remake, and that is a really, really goddamn amazing movie.
Right.
So I can't be, given that evidence, I can't be 100% again. It's funny, like, my opinion about remakes, I kind of depends so much on the spirit in which they're done. Like, for example, The Thing obviously is a, like, different movie than the original movie, but obviously respects the movie a lot. Like, that's okay, but a remake of, like, I didn't see the Friday Night remake. I hear it's actually good, but I haven't seen it. I'm trying to think of some really bad remakes recently. Basically, like, the current remake phase, to me, just seems to be a signaling of utter creative bankruptcy, ultimately. Like,
yeah, did you see the Nightmare on Elm Street remake?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Did you like it?
No, I thought it was terrible.
I didn't see the theaters. I saw it, like, when it was on, you know, some premium cable station, like HBO or whatever was playing it. So I sat down and watched it, and it was like, yeah, I mean, so much of it is wrong. Like, why, I don't understand why Freddy has Christian Bale's Batman voice. Like, why is he doing that? I don't understand.
I didn't get that either. Or, I mean, his face, he looked like a burnt hamster or something.
Yeah.
I didn't. I got the whole idea of, like, it was supposed to be close to what an actual burn victim looks like, but
But I'm sorry, no, like,
the designer, how would you not just step back and take a look at, like, yeah, you know what, that looks really goofy, you probably shouldn't do that.
And also, if I'm not mistaken, I might be, but a lot of it, when I was looking at it, when I was watching it, I was like, they seem to have done a lot of CG work on the face, but, like, noticeable CG work.
Yeah.
So it was, like, it just looked bad, like, distractingly bad. His voice was distractingly bad, and the makeup CG job was distractingly bad.
Yep. And then, of course, I mean, and this is what I couldn't figure out, was just, like, there was a couple, you know, they had the bedroom scene where Freddy comes out of the wall. It was obviously a take on the original scene.
Mm-hmm.
But that CGI, when that happened, I was like, this is terrible. And it was enough almost to just take you completely out of the picture at that point. Or it's just
so,
like,
bad.
It was just so awful. And then, you know, the scene where, and, you know, Nancy's in the bathtub, that, you know, that that scene where, you know, his glove comes out, and it's just, I don't understand, like, why are you going to lift the exact same scene from the beginning? If you're going to do something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
That bothered me tremendously, because, I mean, those are iconic scenes.
It's really, like, it's, yeah, it's really upsetting. But again, I also, like, I kind of like, talking about, like, historical remakes, I kind of like the like, early 90s remake of Night of the Living Dead, the one that Savini directed.
Oh, yeah, that was great. I love it.
It's, like, really, really good. So, I think it really depends on the package and a lot of stuff. But I think, like, the current wave of remakes is really stupid. Although, have you seen Fright Night?
I have not. Actually, we're going with some friends tomorrow. I think I've begrudgingly convinced my wife to go. But I've heard mixed things about that, even within the blogosphere. Even though Rotten Tomatoes, you know, has gotten a good score on it, and most people like it by and large. But some of the characterizations appear to be a little bit off from the original. But I'm still going in with an open mind, as long as it's fun and stuff. We'll see where it goes. I mean, I love the original Fright Night, but mm-hmm. I don't really hold it in this.
Yeah, I don't like. It's not one of my, like, you know. It's not one of my favorite movies, so
yeah.
I won't be that upset if they mess it up.
Not like where Psycho was remade and my soul was crushed. I mean, just like
you know what? For some reason, I've been making. I don't want to call them jokes, but, like, just bringing it up a lot. And I don't really know why, but, like, it's been a common theme in my life for the last couple of months is talking about how ridiculous that was.
It was awkwardly bad. It was just, my God, that whole initial interaction between Vince Vaughn and Aunt Haish when she pulls up and she's, you know, they're going through that whole back and forth of, you know, sign your name and, you know, we have X amount of cabins and, you know, we have 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. You know, it was so awkward. It was so wooden and so weird and surreal. But the way they also delivered the lines was just, oh, man, I cringe.
Are you a Gus Van Sant fan in general?
In general, yes. I thought this was just, it seemed like an egotistical, overbloated, just kind of like, I don't know, like, it's like somebody it's like taking a look at the Mona Lisa and saying I can do better than that, you know, and I think he just bit off more than he can chew, and he was riding high, so he's like, you know, why not? I think it was just one of the biggest missteps in any filmmaker's career. Personally,
what I find odd about it is, like, he's not even, at least to my knowledge, like, I'm not a huge fan of his work, but I certainly appreciate some of it. Like, he doesn't even seem to be a man who's interested in, like, in suspense filmmaking or in the type of movies that Hitchcock made. Yeah. I don't think, like, I see no indication across the rest of his work that he gives a shit about that kind of filmmaking. So, like, what are you doing? I don't understand.
Right, yeah. I would have loved to have been, like, in that room when that conversation was being had between the film company and him, you know. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, like if he kind of did, like, if De Palma, like, all of De Palma's mid-70s stuff is, like, weird riffing on Hitchcock, that would have made sense, because De Palma's a man who obviously is very interested in the same kind of, like, themes and, like, movie construction as Hitchcock. But Gus Van Sant, it's like, what, really? I don't, why? yeah, so weird. And, like, correct me if I'm wrong, I've only seen the movie once, which is, again, the reason why it's great that I talk about it all the time. But in the shower scene montage, doesn't they, like, add other weird things, like a deer in the headlights and, like, weird bits of,
the,
like,
most bizarre scene by far was when it may have been hinted at in the original. I mean, I don't know. I've seen Psycho. I mean, I watch Psycho at least once a year. It's mm-hmm. all-time favorite films. I was in college, and one class, it was the English class, and we had gotten ahead of our coursework, so, like, our professor just randomly busted out, just, like, Psycho, and we watched it for, like, an entire week and dissected it, and it was just, it was a bizarre thing that it happened, like, in the middle of a you know, college English class, you know, mm-hmm. and we just spent a couple weeks on it. But anyways, it even grew my appreciation and love of the film even more because this professor was totally kick-ass. But so getting back to the shower scene, so, you know, he's got the cutout hole that he looks through and, mm-hmm. and sees, you know, Janet Leigh in the original one, right? Also, in the updated version, Vince Vaughn is clearly pleasuring himself.
Oh, yeah, that part, too.
That part was, like, that was just terrible. I'm like, it wasn't even, like, kind of, like, discreetly or kind of, like, you know, hinted at. It was, like, in your face, and, like, and it went on for a while. And I remember people in the theater, like, I've only seen it once myself. That's how bad. Like, I went with my girlfriend at the time in high school to go see it, and it just, everybody in the theater started laughing, and I'm like, wow, this is terrible. And I've still got, like, another 80 minutes or so the rest of the film to watch. I'm like, what would compel someone? I just didn't understand. It was completely a bizarro moment when I was watching it. I'm like, yeah, that might be able to be inferred from the beginning, or from the original film, but why would you go all out to show something like that? I mean,
like, to get back to an earlier point, it's one of those moments where it's like, yes, it can be inferred from the original film, but you don't have to add, like, the jerk-off noises.
I remember that clearly. Like, you're hearing, like, flesh against skin in the flap-flap sound or whatever.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's really embarrassing. Embarrassing for American movie making in general.
I thought so. I'm like, wow, this is really, really, really bad. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of the same level. There's some, like, some remakes that are noteworthy. I've said this a few times to fellow horror fans and mentioned on the blog, but I think the Last House on the Left remake was better than the original.
I didn't see it. I should see it because I've heard it's good, but I haven't. The first Last House on the Left is really, like, that's a movie that I never actually want to see again because it's A, not that good, and B, just kind of makes you feel ill, like,
yeah.
It, which I guess maybe means that it's, you know, effective, even if it's not good, but it's just, I just find it like a really, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like, disgusting movie.
Yeah,
because I've heard it's really good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, it's much more, there's a lot more suspense, a lot more atmosphere, and it wasn't quite as in your face until the family starts exacting revenge on these guys that have, mm-hmm. You know, done wrong to their daughter. But I thought it was a little bit more subdued, especially in the early goings. But I mean, you know, the inevitable rape scene was still pretty brutal and pretty hard to watch.
What, speaking of Wes Craven remakes, what did you think of Hills Have Eyes?
You know, I actually like that one as well. I enjoyed that one. The first one I did. I still haven't seen the second, but I've heard nothing but bad things about the sequel to that.
I didn't see the second one.
Second one. But I actually thought it was pretty good. I thought it was pretty well done.
Yeah, I thought so too. Yeah, definitely. I like that Frenchman. But I didn't see Piranha, so who knows.
Yeah, Alexander Aja. He's been on the remake train recently, ever since High Tension, and he hasn't really done it. And apparently, what's he connected to next? He's connected to another remake, and it just escapes me right now. They just announced it.
Yeah, I didn't hear.
I forgot. But anyways, yeah, Piranha was okay for what it was. I mean, it was just, sometimes you need just a kind of mindless escape type movie, and it's mm-hmm. pretty much what it was.
Yeah.
So back to the film here, a couple closing questions. So it's currently available on DVD and Blu-ray. So where can folks, our listeners that want to check it out, where can they purchase it?
You can, as far as I know, purchase it from any major retailer of you know, fine video products. I know, like, I haven't actually been in a store or seen it in a store, but I know that you can get it from, like, Amazon, and I think you can order it from, like, BestBuy.com, and I'm probably sellers. Eventually, Netflix will have it, And eventually it might be on like Showtime or one of the premium stations, but I don't think that that deal's done yet. So for now, DVD, and then eventually Netflix. So.
Cool. So are you still on any VOD platforms?
That's a good question. When I was obsessively looking at my Amazon sales ranking, as I do sometimes, embarrassingly enough, I think I saw that it was listed, like it was backlisted on VOD, but I don't actually know.
Cool. And I have to ask for my own selfish reasons, please tell me that the amazing poster art is going to go on sale at some point, or I can buy that somewhere.
The poster art is not officially going on sale, but I know because I paid for the printing that we have we have a limited number of like nice posters of it. So you should, I should see how many we have because I've actually made that many because I thought we should sell them. So let me look into how we're gonna do that and I'll let you know.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean I love it. It seems over the last couple of years, too, with a lot of independent productions especially, that there's kind of like this return to the art of the movie poster. And, you know, so much within, especially within our genre, we've seen just kind of like all this Photoshop stuff, especially through the 2000s with your Screams and your I Know What You Did Last Summer's, yep. What you see Photoshop pictures of kids and whatnot.
Yeah, looking pensive.
Yeah. So when I saw it, I was just like, wow, that's amazing. That's.
Yeah, it's funny. We the Tribeca's poster because it's terrible. Like the poster that's good, the like sort of you know vaguely solved actors one. We did ourselves, and Tribeca's poster is. I would like to be kind to it, but I can't. It's just terrible. Like, it's just a fucking terrible poster in my language. They took...
This isn't a family show. It's okay.
Okay, they took, like, a still from the movie, and then they took a still with Patrick Breen in it, but, like moved him from being outside the house to being inside the window, and then created this, like, fake blood splatter on one of the other windows in the house.
Yeah, that's the what we see on the main website right now, right?
Yes, and then there are two fonts. There's like the terrible like somebody used a typewriter font, and then my favorite part is the title of the movie is like a font that for some reason fire red, not blood red, fire engine red, and it's a like a Japanese calligraphy font, which I think they thought looked like blood writing. I don't like. It's just, it's just abysmal. So
you know what it looks like to me? Because I'm also a huge heavy metal fan. It looks like a really bad heavy metal band's logo.
Yeah, it's terrible.
to be honest, absolutely honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, I remember seeing it, like, and we had no poster approval. So I saw it and I was just like, oh, sweet Jesus, like, is that really what you're going with? So then I had a friend of mine who had actually been asking me for a long time if he could do a poster for the movie. I had him do the one, the good one. And then Tribeca was like, oh, this is really good. yeah, I know it is. And yours is terrible.
It's incredible. Like, I love those posters that can just encapsulate just everything about the film in an image, you know? From just the silhouette of Patrick Breen and, you know, the blood and kind of like the draining of the blood in the photo and then the girl in between his legs, I just thought was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good poster. So I'll figure out how we're gonna sell ours and I'll let you know.
Sweet.
I might just give you one actually, but other listeners can maybe buy one eventually when we figure out how to buy them, how to sell them.
Cool. Any other projects you'd like to discuss or tell us about to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, actually, I have a graphic novel that just came out a couple of weeks ago called Petrograd, which is utterly unlike The Bleeding House, but is about the assassination of Rasputin. So it has a really intense murder scene as like a 40-page midpoint of the story. So if you're still or Russian history or spy stories, then Petrograd is worth checking out. And it's like a nice hardbound graphic novel thing. So, and that's about it. I have other things that I'm working on, but nothing that's coming out anytime soon. So, yeah, that's all I got.
Very cool. Well, Philip, I really appreciate your time. I'm glad we were actually able to connect and chat tonight.
Yeah, it was fun.
Best of luck in the future, and best of luck with the film, and definitely keep in touch.
Yeah, I will definitely, and thank you so much. This was a blast.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, thank you for listening, and we will catch you on the flip side.
Bye.
You're a demon, should hear me. You're not a demon, are you?
You're listening to me!